Usually when we talk about a business investment, especially something really tangible like real estate, there's this expectation of precision.
Right, like it's a science.
Exactly, like engineering. You look at a spreadsheet, you calculate the capitalization rate, you inspect the foundation, and it's like looking at an X-ray.
Yeah, the jagged white line shows the broken bone, and the diagnosis is definitive.
Right. It's clean, predictable, and, comforting when you've got millions of dollars on the line.
It's a comforting illusion, certainly. I
Yeah.
mean, we want those variables to be static. We want the spreadsheet to just perfectly mirror the physical reality of the asset.
But then you look at the massive stack of material we have for today's deep
Oh,
dive.
it's a completely different story.
It really is. I mean, we've
Is
got
there?
New York State real estate regulations, hyperlocal municipal fee schedules from Dutchess County, property tax laws.
Plus that cutting-edge tech study on resident retention.
Right, and environmental impact columns. And when you stack all these documents together, that old X-ray machine is just, it's completely shattered.
Completely. We're looking at a regulatory and economic landscape in the Hudson Valley in 2025 and 2026 that, honestly, it isn't binary at all.
No, it's fluid. It's incredibly murky and maybe a little treacherous.
Diagnostic muddy waters, for sure. The foundational metrics for evaluating risk in this space have been fundamentally rewritten.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing in the Hudson Valley isn't just some local anomaly. It is a highly magnified microcosm of an entire national transformation in the housing sector.
Which is exactly our mission today. We are taking this massive, really disparate stack of local documents and trying to extract the actual blueprint of where American housing is going for you.
Because being a property manager today is no longer about just, collecting a check on the first of the month.
Or just dispatching a plumber when a pipe bursts.
Right. It has morphed into this high-stakes chess game involving artificial intelligence, incredibly fragile energy grids, and some of the strictest legal compliance mandates in the country.
Okay, let's unpack this. To understand the mechanics of that chess game, I feel like we first have to establish who actually controls the board right now.
Absolutely. And the leverage has decisively shifted. If we analyze the legal framework, specifically starting with the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act of 2019, the HSTPA, the traditional landlord-tenant dynamic, was essentially dismantled.
Just totally rebuilt from the ground up. Let's start right at the front door with the upfront costs for a tenant.
Historically, that barrier to entry was massive.
Right. You want an apartment, you pay the first month's rent, the last month's rent, and a security deposit.
So if the rent is $2,000 a month, you're tying up 6 grand just to get the keys.
Exactly. But the HSTPA strictly prohibited that. Security deposits are now legally capped at exactly 1 month's rent.
And that concept of requiring last month's rent up front, it's entirely illegal now.
Which just completely severs a major capital buffer for property owners.
It does. But, the shift is even more pronounced before a lease is ever drafted. Let's look at the application fees. The state capped them at a maximum of $20.
I really want to pause on that $20 figure because it's not just a random number someone picked out of a hat.
No, it's highly specific.
Yeah. When you look at the underlying software systems, $20 is roughly the literal systemic API cost of running a hard pull background and credit check through a third-party vendor.
Right. The state didn't just lower the fee, they explicitly engineered the law to strip away the profit margin that landlords were baking into the application process.
That's wild. So application fees used to be a distinct revenue stream.
Exactly. In a high-demand market, a landlord might charge $50 or $100 per application, collect 10 applications for a single unit, and just pocket the difference.
But the law eradicated that, and it goes a step further, right?
Yes. If a prospective tenant provides their own copy of a background check, as long as it was conducted within the past 30 days, the property manager must waive that $20 fee entirely.
So all the front-end revenue and those capital buffers are just stripped away, but the compliance minefield gets far more intense on the back end, like when a tenant actually moves out.
Oh, the 14-day rule.
Yeah, I was reading through the 14-day rule in the statutes, and the operational friction here is staggering.
It is arguably the most critical deadline a property manager navigates today.
So when a tenant vacates, the landlord has exactly 14 days to either return the security deposit in full or
Provide a highly specific itemized statement of any deductions along with whatever balance remains.
And the allowable deductions are incredibly narrow now, aren't they?
Extremely. You're limited to unpaid rent, unpaid utility charges the tenant was legally responsible for, physical damage that goes beyond normal wear and tear, and storage costs for abandoned belongings.
So you can't touch that deposit for late fees?
No. You can't deduct attorney's fees either. And you certainly cannot charge them for replacing a 10-year-old carpet that just looks old.
But the real teeth of the legislation lie in the penalty for missing that window. So landlords used to hold all the cards, but now it sounds like they're playing a board game where one missed deadline, like that 14-day rule, costs them the entire game.
That is a very apt analogy. Let's play this out realistically. Say a tenant moves out on the first of a month.
Okay.
They've punched a massive hole in the drywall. You need a contractor to come out, give you a quote, and fix it so you can itemize the deduction.
Makes sense.
But the contractor gets delayed, the quote comes in late, and you mail the itemized list on day 15, just one single day late.
Oh, wow. What happens?
Under the law, missing that 14-day window triggers an automatic forfeiture of your right to retain any portion of that deposit.
Wait, so the severity of the tenant's damage becomes legally irrelevant?
Entirely irrelevant. You could have photographic evidence of thousands of dollars in destruction. But if that itemized list is postmarked on day 15, you must return the entire deposit.
That's terrifying.
It gets worse. If the tenant takes you to court and the judge determines the delay was a willful violation, you are subject to punitive damages up to twice the amount of the deposit.
That is an insane operational bottleneck. I mean, you're no longer just managing real estate. You're managing a hypersensitive legal countdown clock.
Exactly. The sheer amount of systematized workflow required just to survive that 14-day rule means human memory is no longer sufficient. You need comprehensive documentation protocols.
Like, landlords must now offer a joint inspection before move in to establish a baseline, right?
Yes. And they must offer an exit walkthrough, usually 1 to 2 weeks before the lease ends. This gives the tenant a legal right to cure or repair any damage before the final assessment.
So the entire relationship must be meticulously cataloged from day one.
Precisely. And speaking of cataloging, the changes to tenant screening fundamentally alter how you assess risk. The blacklist ban essentially destroys the old data broker model.
Right. Landlords used to just buy lists of tenants who had been involved in housing court litigation and automatically filter them out of the applicant pool.
But real property law established a rebuttable presumption. If a landlord runs a background check, discovers a past eviction proceeding, and then denies the application,
the legal framework automatically presumes the denial was explicitly because of that court record, which is now illegal.
Yes. It completely flips the burden of proof. It's not on the tenant to prove they were discriminated against.
It's on the landlord to prove they rejected the applicant for a completely different mathematically valid reason, like an insufficient debt-to-income ratio.
Exactly. And if they fail to prove that, the attorney general levies civil penalties. It creates a massive chilling effect on automated screening.
You basically have to meticulously document the exact financial or credit-based reason for every single rejection.
You do. And mind you, these are just the universal statewide baselines. When we zoom into the municipal level within the Hudson Valley, the regulatory landscape fragments into hyper-local volatility.
Yeah, let's look at the City of Poughkeepsie and the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, the ETPA.
This is the mechanism that allows upstate cities to implement rent stabilization.
But they have to conduct a study proving the vacancy rate is below 5% first, right?
Correct. The timeline in Poughkeepsie perfectly illustrates the sheer unpredictability of local operations. In June 2024, based on a commission study showing a 4.03% vacancy rate, the Poughkeepsie Common Council adopted the ETPA.
So immediately, properties built before 1974 with six or more units were thrust into rent stabilization.
Yes. Annual rent increases were suddenly dictated by a rent guidelines board, and tenants gained the right to automatic lease renewals.
But it didn't last. I mean, just a few months later, in November 2024, the New York Supreme Court in Dutchess County completely voided Poughkeepsie's adoption of the ETPA.
They found the methodology of that vacancy study was deeply flawed. So overnight, the regulatory framework vanished. The properties reverted to market rate status.
I'm trying to imagine doing financial forecasting in that environment. In June, your revenue projections are legally capped by a government board. You adjust your entire operating budget.
Right.
Your tenants feel this sudden sense of permanent security. Then in November, the court tears it up. You have total pricing flexibility again, but your tenants are in a panic.
They're likely organizing and lobbying the city council to commission a new study.
As an asset manager, your long-term planning horizon shrinks from years down to, what, weeks?
It is the definition of operational whiplash. And while Poughkeepsie was locked in litigation over vacancy studies, neighboring river municipalities like Beacon and Newburgh sidestepped the ETPA entirely.
Right, by adopting good cause eviction, or GCE, which doesn't actually require a vacancy study.
Exactly. The state passed it in 2024, and towns can just opt in. The core premise is that you cannot evict a tenant or refuse a lease renewal without a legally defined good cause.
Like non-payment, lease violations, or the owner reclaiming the unit for a family member.
Yes. It also provides a mechanism for tenants to challenge rent increases that exceed 10%, or the consumer price index, plus 5%.
But the nuance really lies in how these local towns define the exemptions, right? The state law includes an exemption for small landlords.
However, the legislation delegated the power to define small directly to the individual municipalities.
And Beacon and Newburgh went for the absolute strictest interpretation possible.
They really did.
If you look at their specific municipal codes, they defined a small landlord as an entity owning exactly one rental unit in the entire state of New York.
Which functionally eliminates the exemption. By setting the threshold at a single unit, if you own a modest duplex and rent out both halves, you exceed the limit.
You are subject to good cause eviction.
This means every single non-renewal across almost the entire housing stock in those cities now requires meticulous, court-ready documentation of a legally valid cause.
So if we synthesize this first major piece of the puzzle, your upfront capital is restricted, your screening process is heavily scrutinized under threat of civil penalties, and your margins are legally capped.
Plus, a civil procedural error on a security deposit can cost you thousands in punitive damages.
Right. You are bleeding capital on compliance. But as we pivot to the next layer of these sources, there is a literal bleed happening within the physical structures themselves.
Yes. The legal landmines are just the surface. The underlying economic reality of the Hudson Valley is colliding with its own historic infrastructure. We're moving from legal friction to physical friction.
Yeah, historically, in real estate underwriting, energy was just treated as a standard operating expense, a predictable marginal utility bill.
But Paul Adler's environmental real estate column from our stack frames a dramatic paradigm shift. Energy must now be underwritten as a, quote, quasi-fixed cost with high volatility.
I really want to dissect that phrase. Why is it highly volatile now? Because when I look at the Hudson Valley, I see these gorgeous 1890s Victorians or mid-century brick multiplexes.
They're beautiful, but functionally. Those buildings were constructed decades before modern thermal standards existed.
Right. They have poor insulation, antiquated boiler systems, aging electrical panels. They are physically hemorrhaging heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer.
The physical inefficiency of the asset is the first variable. The second is the fragility of the macro grid delivering that power.
Exactly. The infrastructure is aging, there are massive transmission bottlenecks, and because the grid is still heavily reliant on carbon-based fuels, local utility rates are completely exposed to global geopolitical shocks.
If oil spikes globally, the heating bill in Poughkeepsie spikes locally.
And the sources point out an accelerating demand pressure from the digital economy, specifically data centers.
Yes, they are critical for AI and cloud computing, but they consume staggering, almost incomprehensible amounts of power, pulling massive capacity off the grid.
And the financial burden of upgrading that grid, the delivery charges, the supply costs, the infrastructure hardening is passed directly to the ratepayers.
It is embedded into household budgets and commercial operating statements. It forces a zero-sum calculation for the tenant. Do I pay this volatile electric bill, or do I pay my rent?
While for the property owner, those escalating common area electric costs directly compress the net operating income, which fundamentally changes the math on how we value a building.
It absolutely does.
We are reaching a point where the market is pricing energy risk the exact same way it prices flood risk. You wouldn't buy a house in a FEMA flood zone without factoring in the massive hit to the property's valuation and the crippling insurance premiums.
And the sources indicate that an inefficient, fossil fuel-dependent building is beginning to take that exact same kind of valuation hit. It is a bifurcation of the market.
So properties that have been retrofitted with modern building envelopes, LED lighting, and high-efficiency heat pumps are demonstrably outperforming older, functionally obsolete properties.
Exactly. The capitalization rates are quietly shifting to reflect this. A building that bleeds energy is a higher-risk asset, and its value depreciates accordingly.
But the state isn't blind to this, right? The New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, NYSERDA, is actively trying to intervene.
They've rolled out the AMP Up program, the Affordable Multifamily Program Upstate,
With over $125 million in funding specifically targeted at buildings north of the Con Edison service area.
The incentives are incredibly aggressive. They are explicitly designed to offset the severe capital expenditures of decarbonization.
Yeah, the numbers in the 2025 and 2026 guidelines are huge. Property owners can secure anywhere from $2,000 to $9,000 per unit for whole home heat pump solutions.
There's up to $4,000 available just to upgrade an aging electrical panel so it can handle the load of new heat pumps or EV charging stations.
There's even the SAMES program providing completely free energy assessments for smaller multifamily structures.
It appears, on paper, to be the perfect solution to the energy risk valuation problem.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let me challenge the reality of that. If the market is punishing inefficient buildings and energy costs are volatile, and D, the state is literally handing out up to $9,000 a unit to upgrade, why isn't every single street in the Hudson Valley a construction zone of retrofits?
It's a fair question.
Why hasn't the entire region already transitioned?
Because the incentives, as robust as they are, often collide with physical and bureaucratic reality. First, there is the raw capital expenditure.
Right. Even with a $9,000 rebate, retrofitting ductwork and HVAC into a 120-year-old plaster and lathe structure is astronomically expensive.
The property owner must still front the initial cash or secure high-interest financing.
And even if a well-capitalized investor has the funds ready to go.
That is where they hit the grid capacity wall. The Adler column explicitly highlights this. You might have the capital to install solar arrays and commercial heat pumps, but the local utility grid might physically lack the capacity to accept the interconnection. We are seeing otherwise completely viable, fully funded development projects completely stalled by interconnection delays and infrastructure upgrade requirements mandated by the utility companies.
So you have the money, you have the desire to decarbonize, but the grid simply cannot absorb your project.
Exactly.
So let's look at the board again. You have this crushing legal liability with tenant laws on one side and a volatile structural energy risks stalling against an aging grid on the other.
It becomes glaringly obvious that the era of the mom-and-pop landlord managing a 20-unit portfolio on a legal pad and a gut feeling is entirely dead.
Oh, completely. The margin for error is zero. To survive this ecosystem, you need a completely different tier of professional armed with a highly specific toolkit.
This necessitates the rise of the specialized associate broker and the integration of the AI technology stack. The liability is simply too immense for entry-level management.
Right. I mean, we all know what a real estate agent is, but looking at these new legal standards, the distinction between a licensed salesperson and an associate broker is no longer just a title on a business card.
No, it's a massive legal firewall for liability. The educational and legal disparities are profound.
A licensed salesperson completes a 77-hour qualifying course. It is an entry-level designation.
They are legally restricted. They can only perform fiduciary tasks like negotiating leases or handling escrow under the direct, documented supervision of a licensed principal broker.
But an associate broker has completed 152 hours of rigorous education. They have met the exact same experience and educational thresholds as the principal broker who owns the firm.
They have the full credentials to operate an independent brokerage, but they have made the strategic, often liability-driven choice to operate under the umbrella of a larger capitalized firm.
And the state of New York explicitly recognized this elevated tier in December 2021 by amending the real property law regarding the office manager designation.
Precisely. The title of office manager is now legally restricted solely to associate brokers who have been actively licensed for at least two of the preceding 4 years.
For institutional investors navigating the Hudson Valley, this is critical.
It really is.
Yeah.
An office manager is legally mandated to exercise the exact same duty of supervision over junior salespersons as the principal broker. It creates a bulletproof, documented chain of accountability.
Because they carry the full weight of fiduciary duty. And in this context, you know, fiduciary duty isn't just a corporate buzzword.
Not at all. It translates to absolute loyalty, meaning an associate broker cannot accept kickbacks from a roofing vendor or obscure the fact that they have a financial stake in the snow removal company they just hired for the property.
It also means the duty of care acting as a prudent person to actively prevent the physical depreciation of the asset.
And full disclosure, they are legally bound to inform the property owner the minute one of those local municipal ETPA or good cause laws shifts.
And to execute those fiduciary duties flawlessly in 2025, human capability alone is just insufficient.
You're comparing an associate broker without a tech stack to a master carpenter trying to build a house with dull hand tools. You can have all the fiduciary duties in the world, but if you're tracking 14-day security deposits on a paper notepad, you're going to get sued.
Exactly. I was looking at the software stack highlighted in the sources, and it's essentially an arms race.
It is.
You have Buildium, which the guide frames as the Goldilocks solution for mid-sized portfolios of 1 to 150 units, offering comprehensive accounting without restrictive minimum unit requirements.
And you have AppFolio for the massive institutional portfolios, bringing in advanced AI for maintenance.
But the one that seems truly vital is Brickwise AI.
Brickwise AI is the hyper-specialized tool for this exact market. It is engineered specifically for New York City and the Hudson Valley regulatory environment.
It automates the generation and delivery of New York-specific compliance documents and required legal notices.
Because when the laws are as unforgiving as the HSTPA, automated compliance isn't a luxury. It is your primary shield against punitive damages.
It's like managing a hospital. The AI tech stack is the emergency room triage system. The software acts as the intake nurse, instantly sorting the sprained ankles from the heart attacks.
Differentiating between a routine filter change and a massive legal compliance deadline.
Right, so the human property managers can actually perform the life-saving work without being buried by the waiting room.
That triage metaphor perfectly aligns with the findings in the 2025 Resident Experience Trends and Insights Study from Chamberlain Group's MyQ community.
That study blew my mind.
They surveyed over 2,300 renters and 180 property managers, and the data on how AI impacts the human element of property management is counterintuitive, but fascinating.
Yeah, they identified the four core pillars of resident satisfaction: property management staff, tech solutions, community, and amenities.
You would think, with all this advanced software, tech satisfaction would be high.
But the study found a dismal 27% satisfaction rate among current renters regarding the technology in their buildings.
There is a massive disconnect between the seamless digital experience renters expect, like mobile credentials, smart locks, instant amenity reservations, and the antiquated systems currently in place.
It represents a massive vulnerability for older properties and a huge opportunity for operators who upgrade. But the data on AI integration is where it gets really interesting.
Usually, when consumers hear AI customer service, they panic.
Right. They picture an endless loop of a chatbot refusing to let them speak to a human. But in this study, 71% of property managers desperately want to use AI for coordinating repairs.
And the shocker is that 67% of renters actually feel confident and comfortable using AI to schedule tours and submit maintenance requests.
Why do renters actually like AI in this specific context?
Because the mechanism of AI in property management solves their primary pain point: immediate acknowledgement.
Oh.
A renter doesn't want to leave a voicemail about a burst pipe at 260 a.m. and hope a human hears it at 90 a.m.
Right. They want the AI to instantly log the ticket, dispatch the emergency plumber, and text them a confirmation.
Exactly. But more importantly, the AI handles the high volume, low complexity tasks, which directly enhances the number one driver of resident satisfaction:
the human staff. The study showed that the absolute top priority for residents is overall friendliness and meaningful, empathetic interactions with the property management team.
You simply cannot be a friendly, empathetic human being if you are drowning in 80 voicemails about leaky faucets and lost keys.
By offloading the triage to the AI, the associate broker buys back the time to actually build the community relationships that retain tenants.
It is a symbiotic hybrid model, and the financial return on integrating smart technology extends beyond retention. It directly attacks the energy crisis we discussed earlier.
Yeah, the sources cite data showing that multifamily owners who implement integrated smart home ecosystems, smart HVAC controls, automated lighting, and remote water leak sensors achieve nearly a 20% reduction in overall utility costs.
So the tech stack directly mitigates the volatile energy risk.
And on top of saving money, 54% of renters now expect smart locks and thermostats as a standard baseline, and they are willing to pay a rent premium, often $20 or more per month, for those integrated features.
The technology simultaneously compresses expenses and expands revenue.
So hypothetically, you have deployed the perfect strategy. You have hired an elite associate broker bound by fiduciary duty. They are utilizing Brickwise AI for flawless legal compliance and AppFolio to triage maintenance.
You've retrofitted the building with smart HVAC to neutralize the energy volatility.
You have optimized the private sector variables. But the final boss of property management in the Hudson Valley isn't a needy tenant, a broken boiler, or an inefficient grid.
No, it's not.
The final boss is the local municipal bureaucracy, because all the AI in the world cannot automate town board politics.
Operating here means navigating a labyrinth of incredibly specific, historically entrenched local rules. It is a mosaic of hyper-local control.
Let's examine the town of Poughkeepsie as our case study. The first reality of this bureaucratic maze is that operating in the shadows is legally impossible. Dutchess County prioritizes extreme public transparency.
Between the state, Freedom of Information Law, FOIL, and Real Property Law 291, property records are an open book.
Anyone can access the county's parcel access database online. Using a property's section block lot number, or SBL, a neighbor, a journalist, or a tenant union can instantly pull up exactly who owns the LLC holding the property.
They can see the exact assessed value, the square footage, and the complete tax payment history.
The county clerk maintains every deed, mortgage, and liening in a searchable public database.
The information asymmetry that used to benefit large property owners no longer exists, and the municipalities enforce their highly specific priorities through aggressive fee schedules.
The revised 2026 fee schedule for the town of Poughkeepsie is a perfect example of local behavioral economics. Some of these penalties are designed to be explicitly punitive.
For example,
if a property owner is missing a water meter or is caught tampering with the infrastructure, what the town classifies as theft of service, the fine is a flat $1,000, strictly enforced, plus the actual cost of the municipal parts and labor to repair it.
But the fees that truly reveal the municipality's macroeconomic agenda are the ones governing short-term rentals, the STRs.
This is where fee schedules become zoning weapons. Let's look at the disparity. If you are an investor and you want to operate an unhosted short-term rental, meaning it's an Airbnb, you don't live there, it's strictly a commercial use of a residential property.
The permit costs $2,000 for a one-bedroom, plus $500 for every additional bedroom, and it requires full town board approval.
Contrast that exorbitant barrier to entry with a hosted short-term rental. If the property is your primary residence and you are physically present in the dwelling overnight while the guests are renting a room, the permit is only $300 for the first bedroom and $50 for each additional.
That is a massive engineered price gap, $300 versus over $2,000.
Why the massive price difference for short-term rentals? What's the underlying agenda?
The mechanism behind that gap is preservation. Municipalities across the Hudson Valley are facing a crisis of long-term housing stock. They know the remote work migration has pushed vacancies below 5%. They are using these fee schedules to actively penalize and discourage outside investors from cannibalizing residential homes to run unregulated hotels.
While simultaneously creating a low-cost pathway for existing local homeowners to supplement their income by renting out a spare bedroom.
It is a highly targeted bureaucratic defense mechanism.
And speaking of preservation, the bureaucracy extends to the physical aesthetics of the buildings through historic preservation commissions. The town of Poughkeepsie has an active HPC tasked with designating local historic landmarks.
For a property owner, an HPC designation is a profound double-edged sword. On the restrictive side, a local designation is significantly more powerful than simply being listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
A local HPC designation legally prohibits the demolition of the structure without a rigorous commission review. Furthermore, the commission must approve any proposed alterations to exterior architectural features that are visible from a public right-of-way.
So the red tape multiplies. If you want to replace drafty, inefficient 19th century windows with modern thermal glass to fix your energy risk, you can't just go to Home Depot.
You have to go before a board, present architectural plans, and argue that the new windows maintain the historical integrity of the facade.
It can severely delay modernization. However, the financial upside is substantial.
Right. Owners of income-producing historic properties gain access to lucrative state and federal historic rehabilitation tax credits. They become eligible for specialized preservation grants.
And from a valuation standpoint, properties located within stabilized historic districts statistically appreciate at a faster, more resilient rate than the broader local market.
It's a calculated trade-off, but if you want to understand just how intractable and complicated local bureaucracy can be, we have to look at the historical anecdote buried in our sources.
The 1986 lead agency dispute regarding a development called Woodlands at Hunter's Run.
Yes, it remains a foundational case study in New York State environmental law, specifically regarding the State Environmental Quality Review Act, or CQR.
It brilliantly illustrates the paralysis that occurs when development collides with invisible political borders.
The setup is incredible. It's 1986. A developer acquires a 47-acre parcel of land and wants to build 120 attached single-family units, a very standard suburban project.
The fatal complication is that the acreage straddles the municipal borderline.
Right. 29.3 acres, which will hold 76 of the units, sit inside the city of Poughkeepsie. The remaining 17.8 acres, holding 44 units, sit directly adjacent in the town of Poughkeepsie.
This instantly triggers a jurisdictional nightmare. Two distinct municipalities, two different planning boards, two completely different sets of zoning codes and comprehensive plans.
Under CCAR, when a project requires approval from multiple government entities, one single entity must be designated as the lead agency to coordinate the singular comprehensive environmental review.
Both the City of Poughkeepsie Planning Board and the Town of Poughkeepsie Planning Board demanded to be the lead agency. They held meetings throughout July 1986, and they were completely, utterly deadlocked.
Neither would cede authority over the traffic, drainage, and development impacts.
Because they could not agree, the law required them to petition the commissioner of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, Henry G. Williams, to legally settle the dispute.
The commissioner evaluated the deadlock based on three strict criteria: the location of the anticipated impacts, the capability of each agency to conduct the review, and the breadth of their respective jurisdictions.
The logic of the commissioner's decision is fascinating. He looks at the impacts, traffic, stormwater runoff, and realizes that water and cars don't care about invisible town lines.
The impacts would be regional, so that criterion was a tie. He looks at capability. Both boards had the municipal staff and engineering expertise to handle it. Another tie.
The entire dispute hinged on the final criterion, the breadth of jurisdiction, and the City of Poughkeepsie won the lead agency status based on one granular zoning detail.
The developer needed a zoning change for the portion of the land inside the city. They needed it rezoned from R1 to planned residential development.
Commissioner Williams ruled that the act of considering a zoning change involves fundamental existential land use considerations. It requires amending the municipality's master plan.
Because the city had to decide the actual zoning destiny of the land, they possessed a broader jurisdictional authority than the town, which was only tasked with approving the site plan and subdivision layout within their already established zoning.
It's a brilliant, almost absurd illustration of the reality on the ground. You can deploy your advanced AI property management software, you can calculate the exact payback period of your NY CERTA heat pumps, and you can master the 14-day security deposit rule.
But at the end of the day, you still might spend months arguing with a state commissioner in Albany over which local planning board gets to read your traffic study simply because your driveway crosses an invisible line in the dirt.
It proves that mastering the technological and financial models is only half the battle. Deep, nuanced comprehension of municipal law and local political relationships remains the ultimate barrier to entry for development in the Hudson Valley.
So, if we step back and look at this entire ecosystem, it is breathtakingly strenuous. The legal liabilities squeeze the margins. The volatile energy grid squeezes the margins.
The absolute necessity for high-end tech stacks and associate brokers adds massive overhead.
And the municipal fees and borders act as friction on any attempt to scale. The pressure on both the property owners and the local tenants is immense.
Which brings us to the final critical component of these documents, the safety nets. When the pressure in this highly optimized, highly regulated system bends too far, how does the local government intervene to prevent a total collapse into tax foreclosure and mass homelessness?
Let's look at the safety valves for the property owners first, because the property tax burden in New York is notoriously heavy.
State law mandates that assessors value property at 100% of its market value.
If an owner is holding an inefficient building and believes the town has overassessed its value, the primary recourse is grievance day. They must compile comparable sales data and argue before the Board of Assessment Review to lower the valuation, which is the only direct way to reduce the tax liability.
But grievance day only adjusts the math. What happens when an owner faces a genuine liquidity crisis? Real estate is a highly illiquid asset.
Right. An owner might have a catastrophic boiler failure, a prolonged vacancy, and suddenly they lack the cash flow to pay their Dutchess County property taxes.
Historically, that initiated a relentless march toward tax foreclosure, where the county seizes the asset and auctions it off.
If I'm falling behind on taxes, my instinct is that the county just seizes the asset. But there has to be a mechanism to stop that, otherwise the county just becomes a massive, reluctant landlord, managing a portfolio of distressed, foreclosed properties, which they absolutely do not want to do.
Precisely. The county's goal is tax collection, not property management. To prevent that collapse, Dutchess County recently authorized Local Law No. 2 of 2025, which provides a critical lifeline, an installment agreement for delinquent real property taxes on residential and farm properties.
The mechanics of this are a massive pressure release valve. If an eligible owner is delinquent, they can enter into a formalized written agreement with the Commissioner of Finance.
It requires a 25% down payment of the arrears upon signing. The remaining delinquent taxes, plus accumulated interest, are then amortized over a 24-month period, paid in predictable quarterly installments.
As long as the owner adheres to the payment schedule and does not default on future taxes, the foreclosure process is completely halted. It allows an owner facing a temporary liquidity shock to stabilize their asset without losing the equity they've built to a county auction.
So that keeps the property owner from drowning. But what about the renters? We touched on the remote work migration driving vacancies down and rents to record highs in towns like Beacon and Poughkeepsie.
And this brings up a concept in the sources that I think is the biggest aha moment of this entire deep dive, the AMI gap.
AMI area median income is the foundational metric calculated by the federal government, specifically the Department of Housing and Urban Development, to determine what constitutes affordable housing in a given region.
I want to trace the math on this because it is a massive systemic irony. During and after the pandemic, you had a massive influx of high-earning tech and finance workers moving from New York City up to the Hudson Valley.
When those high salaries enter the local data pool, they mathematically drag the countywide median income significantly upward.
The data from the housing report on the city of Hudson illustrates this perfectly. The median income of the actual long-term local residents of Hudson is substantially lower than the broader Columbia County AMI, which has been inflated by the influx of wealth.
So here is the paradox. A developer comes into Hudson, builds a new apartment complex, and to get tax breaks, they agreed to designate 20% of the units as affordable housing, pricing them based on the federal AMI guidelines.
But because the remote workers skewed the AMI so high, those mathematically affordable rents are actually entirely unaffordable for the local barista, the teacher, or the hospital worker who has lived there for decades.
The government's formula for affordability has detached from the local economic reality. It is a severe structural gap.
And when market rents and even affordable rents outpace local wages, housing subsidies transition from being a supplementary social program to the absolute bedrock of the local rental economy.
We have to look at the Housing Choice Voucher Program, widely known as Section 8, and localized safety nets like STHP, the Solutions to End Homelessness Program, which provides emergency capital to prevent imminent eviction.
And the state fortified the safety net with the Lawful Source of Income Non-Discrimination Act of 2019. It categorized source of income as a protected class. A landlord cannot legally refuse an applicant solely because their rent is paid via a Section 8 voucher. You can no longer write no Section 8 in a listing.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the most sophisticated associate brokers are recognizing a profound shift in how these vouchers operate within the current economic climate. Accepting housing vouchers is no longer viewed merely through the lens of legal compliance or social obligation.
It has evolved into a highly strategic core business strategy for stabilizing an asset.
Exactly.
Let me make sure I'm synthesizing this correctly. We just spent an hour mapping out an environment where application fees are capped at $20, security deposits are legally restricted, you can't check eviction blacklists, your energy costs are completely volatile, and a single missed 14-day deadline costs you thousands.
Right.
I'm looking at the implications here, and you're saying that in an environment defined by extreme unpredictability, leaning heavily into Section 8 housing vouchers is actually the most stable financial move an operator can make.
That is the exact thesis presented in the Pathstone presentation regarding the HCV program. The financial architecture of a subsidized tenancy provides vital insulation against the volatility we've described. The first major advantage is guaranteed income. A substantial portion of the rent is dispersed directly by the public housing authority every single month with absolute certainty.
And the mechanism protects against macroeconomic shocks. If there is a localized recession and a market rate tenant loses their job, they default on the rent and the landlord absorbs the loss.
But if a voucher holding tenant's income suddenly drops, the government's calculation adjusts. The housing authority actually increases their portion of the payment to cover the gap. The landlord's cash flow remains virtually uninterrupted.
The second advantage attacks the friction of turnover. Because voucher holders face significant challenges securing quality housing in a tight market, once they are placed in a unit, their tenure is remarkably stable.
They stay significantly longer than highly mobile market rate tenants, which drastically reduces the massive capital costs associated with turning over a unit painting, marketing, leasing fees, and vacancy loss.
And the third piece, which initially seems like red tape, is the inspection process. The Housing Authority mandates annual housing quality standards inspections.
A lot of old-school landlords view government inspections as a nuisance, but the presentation argues that it's actually a free, mandatory preventative maintenance audit.
If the inspector catches a slow plumbing leak or a deteriorating electrical outlet early, it forces the landlord to fix a minor issue before it evolves into a catastrophic, incredibly expensive capital repair.
In a market characterized by high regulatory friction and volatile operating expenses, the absolute stability and guaranteed cash flow of a subsidized tenancy are incredibly valuable to an asset's long-term valuation. It is the ultimate hedge against the uncertainty of the Hudson Valley market.
Wow. Okay, let's zoom out and try to wrap our arms around the massive journey we've taken through these documents today. We started by diagnosing the extreme power shift in tenant law, the strict caps on deposits, the eradication of application fee profits, the absolute terror of the 14-day rule, and the whiplash of local municipalities battling over rent stabilization and good cause eviction.
We transitioned into the physical decay, seeing how an aging grid and inefficient buildings are transforming energy from a simple utility bill into a systemic valuation risk, effectively redlining inefficient properties like flood zones.
We observed how the industry is adapting to those dual threats, relying on highly educated, fiduciary-bound associate brokers armed with sophisticated AI technology stacks.
They are deploying software like Brickwise and AppFolio to automate legal compliance and triage maintenance, buying back the human time necessary to build the community relationships that renters actually value.
And we navigated the labyrinth of the municipal bureaucracy. We saw how towns use public transparency, aggressive fee schedules, and massive price disparities on short-term rentals to actively shape their demographics.
We looked at the historical absurdity of the 1986 lead agency dispute, proving that invisible political borders can stall even the most optimized development.
And finally, we examined the safety nets, the tax installment plans saving owners from foreclosure, and the strategic embrace of housing vouchers as the ultimate financial hedge against the terrifying reality of the AMI gap.
It is a profoundly interdependent ecosystem. You cannot manipulate one variable, a tenant law, a grid upgrade, a local tax fee, without sending severe operational ripples through every other aspect of the market.
And that brings me to a final thought I want to leave you, the listener, with today. As we synthesized all these sources, the broker guidelines, the tech surveys, the environmental columns, a central theme emerged. Optimization.
How to use AI to triage your maintenance tickets. How to use tax payment plans to survive a liquidity crunch. How to install heat pumps to mitigate volatile oil prices.
It is all about optimizing the existing structures to survive. But I want to look at the macro implication of that AMI gap we just discussed. If this system continues to hyper-optimize, if the remote work wealth continues to artificially inflate the median income, and the local service workers, the teachers, and the hospital staff are entirely permanently priced out of the communities they built, will the very culture that makes the Hudson Valley so desirable in the first place collapse under its own gentrified weight?
It is a very real possibility.
You can hire the most elite associate broker. You can deploy the most advanced AI software to build a perfectly energy efficient, smart locked, legally flawless building. But what is the actual value of that asset when there is no one left in the town who can afford to staff the local coffee shop or respond to the volunteer fire alarm? If the community hollows out into an optimized shell, does the real estate value survive the cultural collapse? Something to think about.
It is the ultimate existential paradox of regional economic success. A highly optimized building is worthless if the community surrounding it ceases to function.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the underlying mechanisms of your local environment. Keep looking beyond the surface of municipal fee schedules. And remember, When someone tries to tell you that investing in tangible assets is a simple, clean, binary calculation like looking at a broken bone on an x-ray, remind them that they are actually staring into incredibly deep, murky, and fascinating waters. Until next time.